This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode. Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. This week on the podcast, we're pleased to present a special bonus interview between Morningstar Editor-in-Chief Nick Owens and Stuart Lucas, author of The Taxable Investor's Manifesto. We'll return on December 4th with our regular podcast programming.
I think we could talk for one minute about essentially the title of your book. And I had a reaction that I guess you reframed for me what non-taxable investors are. And so you point out how what I think of as the group of institutional investors, pensions, endowments, and so forth, that if they're not paying taxes, they're not incentivized to think about those consequences, right? And so that seems like the takeaway for essentially the rest of us who are paying taxes on income and capital gains have to think differently. And so that's really the thrust of your book.
Correct. There are two fundamental differences between individuals and institutions. Institutions don't pay taxes and they don't die.
Yeah.
Right? And I am confident that most investors of Morningstar do pay taxes, and eventually we will all meet our demise.
Right. Those two inevitables, death and taxes.
We have to manage for that.
I mean, we talk a lot about people's goals are the most important thing they should focus on for their investing, right? Versus, let's say, market performance.
I think that, you know, the traditional performance measures that have been designed for financial assets were designed by academics and practitioners who didn't care about taxes. So a time-weighted rate of return, for example, is a perfectly useful measure of the performance of a manager in a tax-free world. But the idea of time-weighted rates of return when used to measure the performance of a manager, for example, or when you're looking to measure your own portfolio, works really well, except when you start taking into account taxes, because the decisions of the manager or the decisions that you make have tax consequences. And none of those tax consequences are captured in time-weighted rates of return. And so you can have different portfolios that have exactly the same time-weighted rate of return, and measured in after-tax dollars, the outcomes are enormously different. One of the ways in which I think, you know, there's an enormous opportunity is to start incorporating measurement of deferred taxes, for example, in client portfolios or in the users' portfolios of, you know, people who use Morningstar's services. And if you track your deferred tax liability as part of what you do, you will make better decisions. I'm highly confident.
That's essentially the whatever your tax rate is on the unrealized gains in your portfolio.
That's correct. So if you have a stock or a portfolio that has a cost of 100 and the market value is 200, and you have a 25% tax rate, then you have a $25 deferred tax liability. And it's a great liability because you don't pay interest on it. It's not callable. In fact, if it's in the form of, if the asset associated with that liability is in the form of a dividend paying equity, the dividends don't go to the government, they go to you. So you actually have a negative cost of capital.
I mean, I think you called it like the zero interest, non-callable government loan, right? Is that sort of how you described it in the book?
Yes. As I say it from at the very beginning, this is not a book about tax. It's really about investing well, given taxable circumstances of individuals. You know, one of the things that's probably it works its way throughout, but is more subtle, is cash flow. And you and I have already talked about cash flow management and how that can, you know, both be a big risk enhancer and a risk reducer. And individuals have much wider span of spending or contributions than institutions typically do. You know, most institutions are spending somewhere between 4 and 6%. per year, whereas individuals might be saving 6% or they might be spending 6%, right? Mm-hmm. And that wider gap is probably the most controllable aspect of personal financial management. And it is hugely impactful over time.
And so in that scenario, we're different from institutions because our goals are kind of time bound and so forth. The question I wanted to ask to follow up on that is, your book spans, you know, so much useful information from the investing process itself, cash flow, like you say, throughout these different aspects, and then how to vet hiring professionals to help you, or, you know, things to look for and conversations to have. I think your book is very useful as a practical guide for folks who are, let's say, in that situation. But could you talk a bit about what you see is potentially helpful to someone who's, let's say, just getting started? You make a few mentions of this in the book itself, but say someone who's 3 years into their first job, they're starting to feel like they might have a successful trajectory and they'll have some savings to work with. What's in it for them in terms of this manifesto?
Well, I think the fundamental messages of the manifesto are applicable to all taxable investors. And one of the most important fundamental elements of it is taking advantage of the power of compounding. And for young investors who are just starting out, the more they save, the more capital they will have at their disposal that's compounded over 30, 40, 50 years. And the power of that compounding, particularly if they invest predominantly or exclusively in equities over a long period of time, is just enormous. So I want to help people get started early. And obviously, starting by investing as much as they possibly can in retirement funds where they get the additional benefit of tax deferment, or in the case of a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k, they don't pay any tax out the back end. That just further adds to the potential for compounding.
And you mentioned a minute ago, you know, so the power of compounding, especially through equities. I think you make a great case for how equities, you know, are a superior long-term asset class. I think you probably lean more towards sort of selecting a few low-cost funds. Maybe you could summarize that argument for equities as the superior asset class.
I'd summarize equities as a superior asset class in that net of fees and taxes, or net of taxes, only equities grow in value. Furthermore, equities are the only asset class that has the capacity to grow and compound on a tax-deferred basis. The vast majority of profit that one generates in a fixed income portfolio are taxable currently. And some people will say, well, yes, but they're muni bonds. And that phenomenon is already kind of priced into muni bonds. So only equities have the capacity to generate long-term capital gains. One of the interesting characteristics of long-term capital gains is that once you achieve 365 days of ownership, then the difference in the incremental benefit of another week or another month or another year is relatively small until you're starting to invest over, call it a 10-year time period. So if I was going to invest in individual securities, one of the things I would do is I would think about what companies would I like to own over the next 10 years, because that should really be your minimum holding period to allow those long-term effects to really kick in.
There's a section in your book I found interesting because a lot of folks who end up either working with you and your firm or having a sizable taxable, you know, investment portfolio, it's because they started a business, right? And that business has grown over time and they've, you know, earned money from it, but or they are selling it. And then there's sort of suddenly changed from being a business operator or owner to an investor. And I think there's an interesting discussion you go through about sort of metrics, how like business KPIs don't seem to translate in the minds of a business owner to investments, and even other sort of transition difficulties that you point out. Would you mind talking about that for a minute? Because I thought there was some interesting insight there.
Sure. If you own a business and you're running it, or for that matter, if you work in a corporation and you're, you know, participant in a share accumulation plan, the way in which you are measured day to day, week to week, year to year is through a series of business metrics. And they are typically tied to the core fundamental characteristics of the business. And those are the things you focus on. And most people who are business owners, particularly private business owners, aren't thinking about what their company is worth today or tomorrow, or what other people would pay for it. They're really just focused on these operating characteristics. But when you start to invest in financial assets, so much of what comes at you, whether if you switch on one of the television channels or read in books or in the information you get from your broker, they're measuring very short-term time-weighted rates of return or some notional idea of alpha and how much value is being created in the portfolio. These are not numbers that are focused on these core fundamental characteristics of business, and they tend to prey on our emotions and cause us to take our eye off that long-term ball and to think short-term. That can in turn cause us to buy when things are looking good and to sell when things are looking bad. In other words, the opposite of buy low and sell high.
I guess the issue is the availability of all that info, right? And some of it's noise, or it's high frequency information like market pricing. It can substitute in, let's say if you're a business owner, you're used to having your scorecards or your dashboards, but you don't have that anymore. And so you sort of substitute in, but then it's not a operating metric, it's a performance metric. That's the,
and it has to be interpreted differently. And I think there's another factor in here too, which is that business owners are generally trained to back their winners and to cut their losses quickly. You know, they try a new product or some new marketing strategy, and if it doesn't work, they cut it quickly. They also, at the first sign of sort of broader economic trouble, will start looking to cut their costs, rein in their accounts receivable, try to extend their accounts payable. This kind of behavior makes a tremendous amount of sense in business, but in the investment world that we operate in, we're really in a mean reverting environment. Mean reversion and these fundamental instincts don't live well together. They live badly together.
There is this trend, right? Sort of a blending between private and public markets is a wider trend. Even if you look at, say, essentially private funds like CITs being put into 401k plans. So it's not just public and private equity, but just public and private markets are kind of blending. And Morningstar is monitoring that with interest. But then most recently, and you know, there's a headline, Vanguard announced they're going to package some private equity funds into some of their products and so on. I'm still interested in your take, and it does sound like you do employ private equity in parts of your portfolios. But the idea of in air quotes, retailization of private equity, what's your opinion of that and how does it comport with a sense of investor protection, maybe even? Are people equipped to evaluate illiquid investments?
Private investments are significantly less regulated by and large than public investments. The assumption that the government regulators make is that only informed investors are allowed to invest in private assets. There's something to be said for that as a goal. But as private equity investments become more and more retailized, there is greater and greater potential for people who are not, in fact, fully informed to end up investing in these assets. And when that happens, unfortunately, people get hurt. One of the ways in which they get hurt is because the fee structures associated with alternative investments in private assets, hedge funds, and the like are much more expensive even before the retailization process. And you add on the retailization process, and that further adds to the fees. And you can look at the fees on the basis of each individual fund, and they're significant. They are also all asymmetric. In other words, the manager gets paid a percentage of assets, regardless of how well the performance is. And that's true with private equity. It's also true with mutual funds and the like. What's different is that there's also a profit participation that the manager gets if the firm makes, or if the fund makes a profit. The problem is that you start adding multiple products into a single investor's portfolio, and the managers are taking 20% of the ones that work, and they're not giving back anything on the ones that don't. And so it creates this adverse asymmetry problem, which ultimately hurts investors unless they're extraordinarily good at choosing successful private equity investments.
I think you pointed out at least two times in the book that it seems that there's a decades-ish long trend that the returns to private equity don't seem to be what they once were. So that problem of that asymmetry might even be exacerbated. Is that fair?
That's correct. There are numerous academics who study the performance of private equity, including Steve Kaplan, who's a longtime board member of Morningstar and a good friend of mine. What the data increasingly seems to be coming back with, that what used to be maybe an average of a 400 basis point per year excess return from private equity has declined to roughly zero. So the average private equity fund these days doesn't appear to be performing much better than the average publicly traded portfolio, even though it's illiquid. So that actually is taking away some of the free lunch that you might have gotten in previous years, just at the time that you're seeing rising costs from retailization.
Thank you very much for sharing with us your book. Like I said, for the wisdom that it summarizes.
Well, Nick, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Much appreciated.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. We hope you have enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening. This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. The podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered tax advice. Please consult a tax and/or financial professional for advice specific to your individual circumstances. Morningstar Research Services, LLC is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analysis, or opinions or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.